Hello, and thank you for joining us on this Monday evening or afternoon if you're in the States. It's not really under the banner of any show, this hangout, but I'm joined by Scott Terry. Scott, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, sir. First of all, I'd like to thank you for having me on the program. The great Alex Botton. We hear a lot about you in the presuppositionalist world, but I don't think you and I have ever actually been formally introduced. So this is actually an honor for me that you would invite me onto your show, and I appreciate that. I guess what I do is I'm just a layman. I'm studying philosophy, trying to get a degree in either philosophy or English, and I'm very much a Christian. I love Jesus Christ, and I stand up for his truths whenever I can in my own fallible ways. And I guess that's about it. I'm a frequent blogger. I have a wide array of interests in all sorts of areas, from political science to racial issues, as you guys know, and rock before to no end. And I like people, man. That's my thing. Like, I like talking to people. I like conversing. I like people from Scotland, like yourself. So, what? Hey, by the way, can I just add really quick? I'm outside. I'm having a smoke. So if you guys hear some wind or if a chicken, like a rooster, starts crowing, just ask me. I'll try to turn my mic
Yeah, there's
around or
actually.
something.
Oh,
So.
I was about to comment. There's actually quite a lot of wind noise at the moment.
My apologies.
Is it particularly warm there at the moment?
Oh, it's beautiful. I'm smoking a cigar outside, having a conversation about theology, philosophy, whatever.
Excellent. So it's quite warm, the air. Excellent. Okay. So, right. Obviously, you'll be known by to some people due to a bit of a I don't know how to word it. A bit of a, would you say, a little storm in a teacup, or a bit of a mini scandal during the CPAC debates during the last election in the US?
I just called that another day. I mean, you guys, anybody that studies the American media and how the American media operates knows that they're going to blow anything they can out of proportion to spin it around. And that's a little bit what we were there to try to do, to trip the narrative, if you will, to trip the political narrative. And it worked beyond our wildest dreams.
But I mean, at the time, you stood up in a Republican meeting and basically endorsed slavery.
Well, I didn't really endorse it, but
But you said
although I
that's,
would, I mean, I'm not. I think I'm probably the only guy in America right now that tries to defend the, or at least investigate the merits of the antebellum thinkers who actually tried to defend, using economic and moral arguments, defend the institution of slavery.
So do you think it's correct to have another human being as property?
Well, correct is a term that isn't really you. That's like a mathematical or logical or something. I mean, are you asking me, is it ethically
Is it right? Do you
normative
believe it? Do you
or?
believe it is right? Do you believe it is acceptable to keep another person as a human as your property?
Well, are you asking me, like, if I believe it's okay to take away a person's freedom of movement for
Well,
various reasons?
by definition, that would be what slavery is. So yes, do you believe that?
Yeah, absolutely. We have prison systems, although I'm not an advocate of the prison system, but I do think that there are various contexts and various situations in which we are morally allowed by God to restrain another person's freedom. Yes.
And what and just you know, just so we can unpack that a little bit, what would be the kind of situation where that would be allowable in your mind?
Well, all sorts of situations are. By the way, can you hear me? Is the
Yeah,
wind
I can
blowing?
hear you. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
That's perfectly fine.
But I really was hoping to get an introduction from you as well, Alex,
Absolutely,
before we
yes.
started getting,
Yeah,
because
of
I
course.
don't.
Yeah.
I mean, you seem like a. By the way, can I just say really quick that I think it's unfortunate that the discussions on the internet kind of spiral into flame wars or whatever. But you seem like a really civil guy, and so that's why I kind of was interested in coming on the show. So I'd like to know a little bit about you, other than, I mean, right now all I know about you is the discussion you had with my friend Ted Curtis last night, and with Saiten Brugenkate, who's also a acquaintance of mine as well. But that's pretty much all I know about you. So.
Right. Well, I mean, I'll give you a quick introduction, then I'll come back to what we were talking about in a moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not trying to dodge the question.
No, of course not. Well, I mean, what would you like to know about me? Ask me how whatever you'd like to know, and I'll just tell you.
Well, what are your interests, your areas of study, kind of how you got to where you are?
I was brought up in a fundamentalist Christian sect. Let me see how else I could describe it. I lost my faith in my late teens, early 20s. I'm not really. It was pretty much kind of. It was. I think the only difference between straight fundies and what my upbringing was that the sect I belonged to wasn't Trinitarian, so it maybe had more in common with Protestant tradition. But took the Bible literally. And yeah, I lost my faith in my late teens, early 20s, and have been a non-believer ever since. What else can I tell you? Artist, musician, I write and do bits of podcasting. So that's about it, really. Married, I've got children by my first marriage. I've got pets, you know. I work for a charity that does good things for people, so... Yeah.
I think the reason why your web podcast or vodcast is so popular is because of that like panda hat that you wear.
Oh, the panda hat. Yeah. It's just over there on the edge of that chair. Can you see it? Yeah, there you go. Yeah. You can see it if I lift the camera up. Okay. So yeah, it's just there, just above the neck of that guitar. So at the other end of my office. Yeah, I don't really wear that very often. It just happens to be the image that. Is my Google Plus avatar.
So, gotcha.
But I do have a selection of animal hats of different types and an Angry Birds hat. But I don't know where my Angry Birds hat is at the moment. But it's.
Are you trying to break into like the atheist TV broadcasting celebrity community?
Not in the slightest bit. I'll just do what I'm doing and stop doing it if I get bored of doing it. I have no interest in being an atheist celebrity or anything like that or whatever that means. So,
you don't study philosophy formally or theology formally or anything?
No,
like
I did do theology at university alongside my art degree. So I was doing I did theology and art with theology being my minor. And that's about it. I put a kind of a layman's interest in these things.
Yeah, I would say I'm a layman as well. So I mean, I don't claim to be like the expert presuppositionalist that has all the presuppositional answers. And so I guess at any point if you ask me a question, I would specify that it's my position that may not necessarily be the same held by all in the community. So, but sometimes I will. Sometimes I will presume to speak for the community if I could take that liberty. But I'll try to be clear.
Okay. So let's get back to where we were before I gave you a bit more information about myself. So you were saying that you feel there are situations where it is the correct course of action to take the liberty of another human being and take that person as your property. And I was asking you, under what circumstances would that be?
Absolutely. Well, obviously, just to take a step back and look at the big picture, this is an ethical issue. And so ultimately, we're going to have to talk about, you know, our ethical philosophies before we can determine what ethical propositions are true or false. But I would say, just to answer your question in kind of a generic way, the old Southerners kind of had a class, almost a Marxist class theory that some scholars have pointed out the similarities between antebellum Dixie and the Marxist. Although, you know, obviously we don't want to say that Southerners are Marxists, but there are similarities to our class theory. And so what got me into this originally, I know this is a long way to answer the question, but what got me into this originally was the Occupy Wall Street movement. Really made me begin investigating class theory from an Austrian economic perspective, class theory from a Marxist perspective, class theory from classical liberal perspectives, and I began seeing that the slaveholders of the Old South had something very similar to what the Occupy Wall Street movement was saying in terms of equating wage slavery with the position of the blacks in the South, because the two positions are very similar. I mean, if you look at it in the context,
if I could cut in there, I mean, they're similar up to a degree, as in that they can be seen as metaphorically similar. But there's a difference between getting paid minimum wage and not getting paid at all, treated like property, and being beaten regularly.
Well, one of the things that Marxists have. Oh, and by the way, if I don't know how our connections are, I know Ted Curtis and you last night were having some problems with lag or whatever. So if I break in over top of you, I apologize in advance. That's not what I want to do. But
likewise.
Yeah. So to answer the question, if you look at there's been a debate between the Austrian economic theorists and the Marxists on value theory, and Marxists would say that Marxists do not include things like logistical infrastructure and creative process put in by the business owners as part of the value. In other words, they have strictly a labor theory of value, which is, I think, what you just kind of alluded to over the mic. A slave is paid, even if it's not a direct minimum wage, paid. His work is reimbursed by means of medical care, medical attention, housing, clothes, and quite a substantial bit of that sort of thing. They would have plenty of leisure time, as is well documented. So I think there is a comparison there between the value theory of the Marxists and the value theory of the old slaveholders. Slaves were, it's not like they just worked for free with absolutely no input. They had all sorts of payment.
So you're saying that somebody who works minimum wage for a company, who can choose not to work for them, who has made the decision to work for them in the first place, and can leave at any time, is the same as somebody who is the property of a slave owner who is not paid and is only looked after in the most basic way that you'd look after any piece of property and doesn't have the freedom to leave. You're saying that they're the same?
Well, think about it. They're legally in a different status, sure, but their situations are very similar in that the minimum wage worker is not free to leave. The minimum wage worker is at best free to move around horizontally. He can choose to go from one minimum wage job to another, maybe if he's lucky, but he has to keep working or else he'll starve to death and get kicked out onto the street. And so it's this, like the slave, if he's working on a plantation and doesn't like the job he's doing, the slave could petition to be moved to another job that he's more better suited at. So it's a lot more of a similar situation than I think people would have a knee-jerk reaction to think of at first.
But do you think that the slave who has no legal right to leave and can be hunted down if they left their owner is in any way the same as somebody working at a McDonald's who, if they choose to, can follow a career path through McDonald's and go up through the way? You don't, once you're in a minimum wage job, you don't necessarily have to stay in a minimum wage job. You can move upwards. It's not just all horizontal movement. So I don't see how you can equate the two with the clear conscience.
With a conscience, that's a different question. But I would just say that there was lateral motion in the Old South as well. It's been well documented. Slaves could work up and even purchase their own freedom. But I do admit that it's not a one-to-one comparison. But the question is, which economic order would be more ethically viable? And my concern with the entire issue, my interest in the entire issue, would be just pointing out that there's a lot more merit in the economy and the social order of the Old South than is usually given credit for. Even if in the end you decide that it's not ethical, that you want to get rid of it, I want to take the best from it. You know, I don't want to just throw the baby out with the bathwater. That would be my only concern.
I mean, do you think there is any best with slavery?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about it this way. People sell themselves into slavery for the most part today. When if you could work for, say, a company, but you had to sign a contract to work for this company for 10 years, But in return, the company would give you a generous retirement and all sorts of benefits. You would always have a relative payment for housing, a clothing allowance, and things. And that's very similar to a military career, by the way, which I have engaged in myself. So that sort of contractual obligation would be far more healthier, in my opinion, for somebody that would willingly go into it than which I'm sure you would want to discuss the willingly going into it part, but I think the relationship itself would be healthier because the employee or the employer, let me just finish this last thought. The employer in this case would have every obligation to care for and to do everything the contract applied. And whereas today it's basically a war. Right, the employer, the big company is constantly trying to find a way to cut down the benefits of the worker, to cut down their medical. You know, it's basically an economic warfare that's going on between worker and employer, and that's what this sort of system would undermine and cut out altogether.
So making people the property of the companies they're no longer paid to work for would be an improvement on making people free to move between companies and be paid for the work.
Well, again, they are paid in terms of basic housing, basic living. They can have upward mobility to the degree that the contract allows. So they would be exchanging 10 years of their life for economic stability and comfort and leisure.
You're a self-defined kinist, which has been described by some groups, sort of lib groups, as being pretty much synonymous with a racist. But I understand that you feel that segregation between people of different ethnicities is to be encouraged. With that being the case, would you then draw your slaves from people of different ethnicities? Would you be happy to draw somebody from your own kin to be your slave?
Well, there's a lot there to unpack. I think, number one, I would, just starting with the way you listed it, I think we should have freedom of association, period. So among free people, we should have the ability to live with whomever we want and or associate with whomever we want or serve whomever we want in our businesses. If we choose to segregate, well, you know, we should have the freedom to do that. If we choose not to, you should have the freedom to do that. That's just the way a free society operates. Unfortunately, in America today, we do not have that freedom. They've basically outlawed the freedom of association, and we're seeing that more and more. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So, well, I was just going to say about that. So you're saying that you should have the freedom to associate with who you wish. So would you feel that it would be acceptable to put a sign on a door if you chose to on your shop door saying no blacks? Would you say that was acceptable?
Absolutely.
And you don't see
Or no homosexuals, or no Mormons, or no lawyers, or, I mean, any it's your business. You serve who you want. The government can't step in and say you have to serve. You know, that's just asinine to say that the government has the power to restrict who you serve, who you associate with.
So, don't you see that as a tremendous step backwards?
Well, I don't think that progress should be defined by how much the society accepts egalitarianism. But again, just to be fair though, Alex, this all is going to ultimately descend back to our differences in worldview and our differences in ethical theory.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a few moments. I mean, before we do that, I just want to because I'm just really trying to get to the clear picture of who I'm talking to here. So. You made a comment about not being, you know, people having the right not to serve homosexuals as well. So are you opposed to homosexuality?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know if you know this, but the presuppositionalist community is highly by the way, I am a presuppositionalist. Mm-hmm. As I'm sure you know, but just for your audience, I am a presuppositionalist. I consider myself a student of the Bahnsen and Dr. Van Til form of presuppositionalism. And I don't know if you know, Dr. Bahnsen was a big mover and shaker, not just in apologetics, but in something called a theonomy. So there was a big movement for theonomy that really got going in the 70s. But it's kind of flatlined now, unfortunately. But still, there's a segment in the Reformed mostly Presbyterian community that holds to theonomic ethics. And what that means is we want the Old Testament Levitical case laws, the continuing validity of the Old Testament case laws enforced by the state today. And by the way, that's part of how I can justify things like slavery, because the Old Testament case law does allow for slavery in a wide variety of circumstances.
So are you saying that Greg Barnson was an advocate of stoning homosexuals to death?
Absolutely. Well, let's qualify. Stoning criminals to death.
Them in some way.
Executing criminals to death, yes.
And do you class being homosexual as a crime?
Well, the Bible does, yes. So
you would like to see a return to a form of government where the state mandated the death penalty for people who are homosexual?
Well, God mandates the death penalty. The state, or I don't like the word state, but the ruling authority, the patriarchal authorities would carry out God's commands. If the homosexual was, I mean, you would have a fair trial, of course. I mean, just like any, we wouldn't slaughter people in the streets.
What would the fair trial look like? I mean, how would you judge whether somebody was homosexual or not?
Well, in the Bible, a person can only be executed at the behest of two witnesses. And so it would really be hard for a homosexual to, he would have to really be out of the closet and flagrantly marching down the street with a rainbow flag, you know, that sort of thing. But he could definitely hide his crime and get away with it for a while, as long as he did it in the closet where it belongs.
Do you then believe that that homosexuality is a choice rather than a genetic issue?
Well, from an apologetic position, that's irrelevant. I have my personal opinions on it, but even if it was something that the person was compelled to do by his genetic makeup or whatever, it would still be a capital crime.
So you're saying that it would be a capital crime for somebody to act on the genetics that they have been given, I assume you believe, by their creator?
Yeah.
So if somebody's been created gay, you think they should be punished for that, for acting on what they've been then created to be like?
Yeah, and I mean that's just kind of an extension of the so-called moral argument, the evil argument from evil that we would have to deal with apologetically. But yet, ultimately, if a person commits homosexuality or a homosexual crime, regardless of why, that point that I would make now at this point in the discussion is, regardless of why the person committed it, he would be held liable for it. Unless, of course, like if somebody held a gun to his head and made him do it, that would be different.
If somebody holds a gun to somebody's head and makes them bum another man under duress, then that's okay?
No, well, they would not be guilty of the crime because there's no intention on their part to do it.
But would the person receiving be guilty of the crime? Would there be two witnesses because of the person who was made to do it and the person holding the gun?
I'm sorry, can you re-ask that question?
I was saying that in the hypothetical situation, there'd be the person holding the gun, the person whose head the gun is held to, and the person receiving the bumming. So would that person who was the receiver then be guilty of the crime of homosexuality because the other two could be a witness?
It all depends on it all depends on the context. Excuse me, I'm smoking a cigar, so I'm kind of having to do it. But yeah, it would depend on the context, and we would have to depend on the godly judge in that situation to take all the facts into account, just like we would now in any other crime. A judge today has to take all the relevant facts into account. And really quick, can I slide something in here? Really
yes,
quick.
Of course.
It's not just at the behest of two witnesses, but we have to consider all the other evidence as well. But two witnesses for an execution are at least required. So if you had a bunch of evidence for somebody committing a capital crime but did not have two witnesses, well, then you still wouldn't be able to execute them. So you would have to have two witnesses as well as all the other evidence, presumably.
Well, I mean, while we're still on this topic, I mean, the country Uganda has just made homosexuality a capital crime. Well, they were going to, but they've removed the element that would involve actually executing convicted homosexuals, and they've now changed it to between 7 years and 40 years in jail. Would you say that they haven't gone far enough then?
Yeah, well, like I mentioned earlier, I'm not... just building on Dr. Bonson's legacy here, I would be an advocate for prison reform. I think prisons are an inhumane form of punishment. There's nothing about jail systems in Scripture. So I do think that they should either execute them or set them free, one or the other. They need to make up their mind there. But imprisoning them for years on end is just cruel, cruel and unusual punishment.
Does any of the thinking you come to, does any of it come from Roosters John Rushdoony? Is he an inspiration at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's one of my patron intellectual influences.
Mm-hmm. He denies that the Holocaust happened. Do you also deny the Holocaust happened?
It's not something I've studied that much, but I do hang around with many people who are quote-unquote Holocaust deniers. But I think I'm not qualified to comment there, so I don't really... I mean, I have opinions. I don't believe some of the evidence is good. Some of the other evidence presented is better, but it's not something I've thoroughly evaluated enough to take a public stand on. Although, I think if you look at what Rushdoony actually said, the rhetoric that he said is not your average everyday Holocaust denial material. So I think it's a little bit of a pejorative to say Rushdoony was a Holocaust denier, but whatever.
I mean, does he deny that 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazi Party during World War II?
It's my understanding he would probably say that it was less, maybe something like 2 or 3 million.
But is that better?
You tell me. I mean, is it Holocaust denial to say that 5.3 million Jews died instead of the exact six number? Or
is there? Exactly? I don't know. Is there a sliding scale at which point a genocide becomes a Holocaust?
Question.
At two million, does it suddenly? At 2 million, is it a genocide? And then at 2.1 million, does it become a Holocaust? Where's the cutoff point?
Well, see, that's my question. I think a lot of times the phrase Holocaust denial is just used in a way to browbeat someone. I mean, how much of the official narrative do you have to accept before you're maligned in polite society? That's the question.
Well, I mean, from my point of view, my father was a history teacher, head of a history department, and my grandfather was actually directly involved in World War II, and grew up grew up beforehand. So, I mean, those two men that, you know, obviously I'm directly related to, are under no illusion that the Holocaust didn't happen. They know full well that it did, through direct experience and access to people who had direct experience. So do you deny, even though the overwhelming evidence is that this thing happened, do you not, you're saying that maybe it was a lesser event, and you said to yourself that you hang around with people who would self-identify as Holocaust denialists. And, I mean, why do you hang around with people like that?
Well, I hang around with you, too, so don't
well, you don't, though, don't, do you? I mean,
we don't hang out socially. At the moment, we're hanging out, I guess. At the moment, we're friends. But let me just answer your question. The question is, what is the Holocaust, for one? Are you talking about the mass, some sort of self-conscious system of destruction?
The extermination of the Jews during World War II, instigated by the Nazi Party under the leadership of Adolf Hitler.
Like I already said, I'm not... This, I mean, to be fair, this isn't something that I've really studied that much, although I have looked into enough to be able to question certain aspects of the official story. But on that note, let me just give you something to play with here. I think as any intelligent person that studied a historical event needs to be willing to look at it critically and not just blindly accept everything that he's told without really looking into it. I think that's something that we can all agree with. So, I mean, are we going to accept every official government narrative of every event without critically analyzing it? So I guess what my position on the Holocaust, just to sum this up really quick, would be I'm an advocate for studying it critically. I'm not an advocate of simply just accepting official stories at face value. And if that makes me a Holocaust denier, then fine, I'll I don't mind being associated or described by the term, but...
Would you, before we go on to your religious beliefs, you say that your the people you associate with who are Holocaust deniers, would you say that they also possibly self-identify as neo-Nazis?
That's another term that gets thrown around quite a bit. I am not a National Socialist. Most of the people I know that would claim to be Holocaust deniers are not National Socialists. Although I do know people who are National Socialists. But you know, like I was saying earlier with my economic views, I've been highly influenced by the Austrian economic school, and so I would strongly disagree with National Socialist views. But anyway, just to answer your question directly, not everybody who's – in fact, I would even say the majority of people who are serious about studying the narrative of World War II are not – neo-Nazis. The neo-Nazi, like the skinhead type, they're usually just parroting rhetoric or whatever. They're not really seriously looking into things from a scholarly perspective. But that's just my view from, that's my view as somebody who kind of looks at the far-right racialist movement with a critical eye.
Okay. So, I mean, I don't think we've got an answer on the question about whether you would seek to say, take slaves from your own kin or not.
Ah, yes. Yes, I didn't answer that. That has been much debated. I think it's been, like George Fitzhugh was one of the intellectual defenders of slavery in the South, and he argued that it doesn't work with people of your own race as well as it would work with different races. And I think given my kinism, what I would say to that is that I want homogenous nations. I think that is the biblical norm for nations, to be racially homogenous. So if we're going to have some form of biblically based institution, it would have to be inter-ethnic. Or if we, for instance, went to war with if we went to war with somebody else, then we could take them as slaves. And I think that would probably be better because you would already have that inherent sense of otherness between the two classes, and it would just work better. I think it worked gloriously in the South.
So you think? So you're saying that you think that and obviously you've tied this to Greg Bahnsen. So you're saying that possibly your views are that do you think the parts of the Geneva Convention that deal with the idea of taking prisoners of war and then keeping them as slaves after a war should be got rid of? Do you think that kind of thing should be just got rid of, and that if you're at war or you're ethnically different from someone else, you're completely justified to take that other person as a slave?
Well, the ethnic, or you're using the word ethnic. I wouldn't use the word ethnic here. I would say, although we could, so I'll just stick with that. I don't think it's because of their ethnic differences that we would take them as slaves. It would be because of the class theory that I was mentioning earlier and the biblical justifications for taking people as slaves, not necessarily because of it. In other words, I wouldn't say, well, they're a different race than I am. Let's go enslave them. I don't think anybody, even the old South, thought that way.
Although they kind of did, though, didn't they? The old South. They did kind of think that these are black people. They're not as advanced as we are. Let's enslave them.
The advancement thing was the issue, though, not the race. It wasn't, black people, let's enslave them. It was, there's people who are not civilized. They're not. They haven't experienced enlightenment, rationalism, and all these other things. So let's enslave them. I mean, it wasn't racial.
Do you think black people are unenlightened and less civilized?
I mean, which ones?
As a group, but you know, you've talked about the other as the as a group, having some kind of separation between groups. So, do you think that whites are inherently superior to people of other ethnicities?
Well,
or other races, if you want to put it that way.
I point out often in my writing as a Kennist that asking if one group of people are superior to another is really an incoherent question. It's like asking, is an apple superior to an orange, right? I mean, how an apple is superior to an orange.
It's subjective, isn't it? I mean, do you think subjectively that they are?
It's not subjective in that we can compare objective character traits. So especially as a Christian and as a Kennist, I believe that God created every person, every people group with an inherent value to them. I mean, we as Christians, we believe all men have value, certainly. That's why we don't believe in murder. So all men have a reason. All races have a reason. All genders, like male and female. Like, you can't say that a man is superior to a woman in a generic, abstract way. You have to ask, superior at what? Superior in what way?
And I think do you agree with the biblical view, though, that women should be silent and that men should take the headship of the family?
I do absolutely agree that men should be the head of the family. Women should be silent in church. That's the context. You're talking about Paul's admonition for women to be silent in church, which I think is just an extension of the patriarchal system of Scripture. Women should be submissive to men in terms of legal and social situations. But that doesn't mean that women are somehow less valuable than men. Which is the point that I would really want to make. And that doesn't mean that white... I mean, I think black people are superior at whites in many things. I mean, black people... A white man is never going to be a superior black man to a black man. And a black man's never going to be a superior white man. We all have our specific God-ordained reasons for being here that we all have to figure out and work for.
And to put it bluntly then, if you were to find out tomorrow that your God didn't exist and that the Old Testament wasn't true, would you immediately ditch, to put it crudely, the racism, the homophobia, and the misogyny?
Well, I don't define myself as homophobic. I don't think these words have any meaning. But if hypothetically I were to wake up tomorrow and have one of the guys in your chat room definitively disprove God's existence, well, that would be I can't even speculate about what I would do. I don't think I would immediately run into the arms of egalitarians and modernist thought, but I don't know. I honestly couldn't tell you where I would go from there.
Okay, I think what I'm digging at here is, were you attracted to... am I right in assuming you're a Calvinist?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so were you attracted to Calvinism because of your, and again to put it crudely, inherent racism, misogyny, and homophobia? Or did those traits of Calvinism appeal to you, or make you that way? Did you go into it not like that and then become more entrenched in those positions because of the Calvinism?
Oh, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, I went into Calvinism kicking and screaming. I did not want to be a Calvinist. But reading Scripture, actually, especially reading Romans, is what began drawing me out of my rank Arminianism. I think I was raised in a culture, or at least a religious culture, similar to what you've described, and that we were very antithetical to Calvinism. I wasn't even able to articulate my views on race, politics, or anything of that sort. So I think Calvinism and consistent biblical anthropology has helped me, definitely helped me articulate my views, but it wasn't because of my views that I chose to be a Calvinist. Okay. Any more than you've probably chosen to be an atheist because it supports your your advocacy of sick sexual fetishes and all the other things you advocate for.
Well, I mean, I'm not aware that I have advocated for sick sexual fetishes, but do you believe that? There's a lot of that warming there. I couldn't hear what you said, the last thing.
Oh, I said, well, if you're not an advocate for sick sexual fetishes, then I'm not a homophobe or a racist.
Okay, so do you think that being a non-believer makes you automatically somebody who's an advocate for sick sexual fetishes?
No, absolutely not. No. Any more than being a Calvinist makes someone automatically a chemist. Although I do think that God will sanctify us over time and bring us to biblical views of race, as he's doing in the church, by the way.
It's got a racist.
I'm very glad to see it. I don't know what the word racist means, but I do know that God created all of them.
Well, okay, well, let's change it this way. Does God think that some people are racially less superior than others?
Well, again, I've already discussed that. I don't think God... it's incoherent to ask if one person is... Or, I'm sorry, if one race is better than another. I think God created all the beautiful diversity, and he wants us all to live harmoniously together, respecting each other's particularities and the beauties of each other's inherent in each other's races.
Okay.
So if that is a racist, then yeah, God's a racist.
Okay, a little hypothetical for you before we move on. If, say, the black community in the USA became extremely Calvinist and decided and became kinist and decided to enslave the white community, how would you feel about it?
Well, first of all, I think most black people inherently, just as a default position, are kinist. We could see this, there's strong ethnic flavor in the black community. That's why we've had such success reaching out to blacks. They understand inherently God's teaching on these sorts of racial issues. They understand what it means to respect their own people while respecting others from a distance. There's nothing wrong with that. But secondly, I don't think that just being a kinist implies, therefore, that you go out and enslave people. Although I do think if the black community did form their own black nation somewhere and were ruling themselves according to theonomy as I conceive of it, and if they went to war with a white nation, then they would be free to take slaves, sure.
That's not really the question I was asking. I was asking, how would you feel about it if you were enslaved by a black majority and you were made a slave to black people? How would you feel about that?
I would much rather be a slave to a godly, theonomic black society right now than to live in Obama's America, sure.
And
because at least there...
And
at
what's
least
wrong
there
with Obama's America?
what's right with it, I think, is more, I mean, well, from a Christian perspective, contemporary America is just a very satanic country with all of its endorsement of slaughtering infants in the mother's womb and all of its allowing of these sick sexual freaks to walk and march openly in the streets. I mean, that would not happen in a black theonomic society. It wouldn't even happen in a black society today. Black people in general despise homosexuality, as we could see back in the ruling of in California, where the majority of the blacks in California voted to outlaw homosexual marriage. Unfortunately, that was overturned by the sick white liberals who were in power over there. But again, I think it's crucial to point out that the black community in general is far more Christianized inherently, at least in terms of ethics, on a foundational level on these particular issues like racial solidarity and an initial revulsion of homosexuality.
So are you saying then that as a community you would say that it would be a broadly correct statement if you were to say that you think that most blacks are homophobes?
Well, I don't use that term. That's a emotionally laden bully term that
okay.
doesn't really mean anything.
Okay, then most blacks would see people who are attracted to people of their own gender as being, I think, how did you describe it, sick pervert freaks or something you described them as?
Well, let's just get rid of the pejorative language and just use the phrase homosexuality. That's the neutral term, I guess. And I would say that if you look at black popular culture, there's definite condemnations in rap music all the time. I mean, you hear... what's his name? Oh goodness! Forgive me for not being up to speed on my hip hop, but there's a lot of condemnation of homosexuality in rap music, for instance. And there's, statistically speaking, blacks in America tend to vote for pro-family, anti-homosexual agenda when they do vote.
And do you think that's correct?
Absolutely.
That okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So. The issue we've got then is that you've got this belief in a God, and you've said that you're a presuppositionalist. Now, you've also said that Greg Banson was actively against homosexuality, and he's one of the kind of, along with Van Til, he's one of the kind of key proponents of modern presuppositionalism. You've also mentioned Seitenbrug and Kate. Now, I've no idea what his opinion is of homosexuality, and I wouldn't even want to hazard a guess at how he feels about it. So you're a presuppositionalist, so unpack that a little bit for me. Explain to me what that looks like from your position.
I'm sorry, what, presuppositional apologetics?
Yeah, understand by presuppositionalism, yeah?
Well, so we have this philosophy professor named Jellema in up north, and he was the teacher of not only Van Til, but he instructed Alvin Plantinga, he instructed Nicholas Wolterstorff. So what we have is coming this tradition, almost call it an Augustinian tradition of, to put it in the old Augustinian canon, that we believe in order to know. And so But specifically from a Van Til-ian perspective, what Van Til was trying to do was to take all the advances in Neo-Calvinism that were going on at the time, specifically in Holland, from the likes of Dooyeweerd, from the likes of Herman Bavinck, from Abraham Kuyper, and what he was trying to do was condense this theology down into a usable apologetic methodology. So what presuppositionalism ends up being is just an assertion of an apologetic, or let me put it this way, a polemical assertion of classic Reformed theology. And that's, I think, the best way to look at presuppositional apologetics is just a mere assertion, a polemical assertion of Calvinist theology.
So what use is it then if it's just an assertion?
Well, I changed that. That's not a good word. It's a polemic. It's a package. It's a way to package the entirety of Calvinist theology into a polemical, a usable tool for debate.
Okay. I mean, because both yourself and Saito and Brueggenkate have described the presuppositionalist argument as being designed purely to shut the mouth of unbelievers. Is that the case?
Well, I don't know if that would be the way to characterize presuppositional enterprise, because, again, if you understand a Reformed theology, what you have is the type of God, the type of theological system that, in our view as presuppositionalists, mandates. I mean, we are obligated, if we're Calvinist, we are obligated to argue in a way that always keeps God as sort of an externalist, an authority that we're not allowed to give up to be consistent with our Calvinism. So, yes, it's sometimes been characterized as a way to silence the foolish talk of unbelief, which, by the way, is biblical words. But I wouldn't say that that would be a good caricature, because that would kind of bias, or it would set it in a light that isn't necessarily accurate. But yeah.
I mean, because the reason I ask that is because you did say once I'd spoken to, or before I'd spoken to Ted, I can't remember which, that you described me as, if I wasn't going to debate you, as being one less mouth to silence, or words to that effect. And Cy has said that it's designed just to shut the mouths of non-believers. So, I mean, is it really designed as a way to confuse and befuddle your opponent to such a degree that they just walk away from you in shaking their heads, just going, why am I even talking to this person?
Well, 2 points I would like to make in response to that. Number one, we don't want to confuse and befuddle our opponents. That's not what we're trying to do. And unfortunately, on the popular level, a lot of popular presuppers, they learn some of the rhetoric, they learn some of the talking points, and that's what they're out there trying to do. And that's unfortunate. Like, I think any good apologist for any position, I mean, even an atheist like yourself, assuming you call yourself an atheist, even atheists would, presumably an intellectually honest atheist, would want to explain his position in an understandable, clear way to have a good, genuine conversation. Unfortunately, we're all sinners, right? Atheists, Christians alike, a lot of times emotions get involved. We're just trying to beat each other up. So a lot of times it does, unfortunately, descend to that level from both sides. I mean, I'm not saying that Christians alone are guilty of this, because atheists do it too, but it's a human problem.
Well, I have
but
to...
the other point...
Object to something you just said there, saying that we're all sinners, I don't believe in sin, because I don't believe there's anybody committing the crime against. I do not class myself as a sinner, because I do not believe in sin. So
granted,
I think
granted,
I just need to qualify that. Okay.
Well,
so
I was,
you're
I
all
was
sinners,
kind of, that,
but we're not.
Well, let me put it this way: everybody is guilty of doing this sort of thing, right? It's okay. Something that's not unique to the Christian position. It's what the point I was trying to make. But the second thing I would say is that we need to distinguish between what our job, when I say we, I say as if we're going to talk about Reformed apologetics and presuppositional apologetics, we need to distinguish between the apologetic methodology itself and how we characterize the methodology itself with what our task as apologists is. Our task is to silence the foolish talk of unbelief. So you can character the task that we have as apologetics as silencing, but don't characterize the entire apologetic methodology as just some way to silence, because I think we would see our apologetic methodology as just a logical outgrowth of our theological system that we believe in.
Okay. So you would like to see, so just so I can just kind of clarify that in my head, you would like to see Mosaic law style theocracy in place globally, I assume, with apologetics in place to silence those who would criticize it. Is that correct?
The first part of your statement cut out there. Can you?
Okay. Would you like to see a theocracy, a global theocracy based on Mosaic law, with apologetics in place designed to silence those who would criticize that theocracy?
As a presuppositionalist and as a theonomist, I do hold to an end-time position called post-millennialism, which is fairly common among theonomists and presuppositionalists. So the post-millennial end-time proponent, like myself, believes that in the end, what's going to happen is all the races, all the nations are going to ultimately be converted to Christianity, and that's what we want, is one worldwide kingdom of Christianity with God as the international king and various nations serving under him as dutiful stewards and regents.
And how's that different from extremist Muslims who want to see a global Sharia law?
If you're interested in comparing Sharia law with theonomic case law, I could direct you to Dr. Gary North's wonderful essay on the topic, which
I'll
try to summarize.
That's not what I asked.
Yeah,
what I asked
well, I'll try
what's
to summarize.
The difference?
First of all, Gary North's article clearly highlights the difference, but just to point out a few obvious things, Sharia law and Levitical case law are two very different things. They presuppose very different theories of justice. They presuppose very different... In a sense, you're right that the Muslims do want to spread Sharia law all over the world. So in a sense, we're similar in that respect. But think about it this way. There's many Enlightenment thinkers who believe in Enlightenment rationalism who want to spread Enlightenment democracy around the world. I mean, that sort of thing is very popular among certain neoconservative elements in America at the moment, and I think it's popular in the UK as well, especially with the immigration policies that you guys have. David Cameron has been recently circulating around articles about his immigration policy. So I think everybody wants the whole world to believe like they do. That's not something that is unique to Muslims or unique to Christians.
But how would you approach it if somebody refused to accept your viewpoint? If you were trying to impose this global theocracy, what would you do? Would you then force them to do it? Would you use violence to convert them, or would you just kill them?
Good question. That's a question we often get as theonomists, and this is another big difference between us and Sharia law. And as Rush Dooney and as Dr. Bonson have pointed out time and time again, we are not revolutionary in our rhetoric. So the way the Christian government spreads is not by the point of the sword, but rather as evangelism. So I want to convince Alex Botton to be a Christian so that Alex Botton will support Christian political governments and things of that sort. But it's an evangelistic thing. It's not a physical violent.
But what happens if I don't accept it, and you've exhausted all avenues, and I'm sitting there in your little theocracy, and I'm a thorn in your side? How do you deal with me?
So the question is, if by some stroke of good providence we are able to institute a Christian theocracy, and there's still 500 or 600 people or whatever in the country that do not accept it, what would they do? What will we do? Well, if you look in biblical case law, there's nothing there about executing people who disagree, although you would not be able to participate in certain elements of the society, certain social programs that are through the church and all that. But I think to answer your ultimate question is you would either stay there and be miserable, or you could just move to another place where there's a bunch of atheists.
Yeah, but if it was a global theocracy... But if it was a global theocracy, and I couldn't move anywhere without being within this theocracy, and I was actively agitating against your position and advocating the downfall of your theocracy, what position would you take? Would you not eventually have to have me killed?
Well, it depends on the manner of your agitation. I mean, if you commit a capital crime, certainly. But if you just sit around not doing anything, I don't see the problem. I'm not an expert on the Old Testament case law, but we could look through law by law to see what you would be allowed to do and what you would not be allowed to do. But
doesn't the Bible instruct you, if a town nearby doesn't believe as you do, to go and kill them?
Not that I'm aware of. You could point
Let me have a look. Yeah. See if I can find it.
Look that up.
Okay, kill the entire town if one person worships another god. Let's see what we've got.
Let me make it easy for you. If you find it in the Bible, and if you're able to consistently apply that to today's context using the hermeneutic that we theonomists use, in other words, if it hasn't been specifically abrogated somehow by the New Testament, then yes, as a Christian, I'm obligated to believe that. Well, whatever the Bible teaches.
Deuteronomy 13 appears to advocate that. I'm surprised you're not familiar with it.
I mean, I'm not familiar with a lot of the... I'm not familiar... A lot of times unbelievers like yourself try to negatively caricature scripture verses and present them in the worst possible light and try to make us Christians defend readings of the text that are not necessarily the correct readings of the text. And I'm not obligated to defend your understanding of Deuteronomy.
Well, I don't expect you to, but have you read the Bible?
Oh, of course.
How many times have you read the Bible?
Quite a few times, actually, as a Christian apologist. But I hope you'll forgive me if I don't be able to recall to my mind every single verse.
I mean, this one would be quite an important one for your particular thing. Let me see what we've got here. Let's see. Okay, Deuteronomy 13, verses 13 to 18. This is the King James Version. Certain men, the children of Belial, are gone out from among you and have withdrawn the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods which ye have not known. Then shalt thou inquire and make search and ask diligently. And behold, if it be truth and the thing certain that such abomination is wrought among you, thou shalt surely smite the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, destroying it utterly and all that is therein, and the cattle thereof with the edge of the sword. And thou shalt gather all the spoil of it into the midst of the street thereof, and thou shalt burn with fire the city and the spoil of every whit from the Lord thy God, for the Lord thy God, and it shall be a heap forever, and it shall not be built again. So it's basically, it seems to be saying in Deuteronomy that if you hear that the town next to you is worshipping false gods, or I would assume you could extend that to not worshipping at all, then you have a verse there giving you permission to go and murder them. Would you then
do
that?
Well, first of all, just to make it very clear, if that is what the Bible ends up teaching, and if that is something that that we have to end up obeying today, then absolutely I would advocate for it. I mean, it's a command of God. Okay. But I don't think we're obligated to that reading. Okay. I mean, I'm not... off the top of my head, I can't give you an exegetical study of that passage, but okay. I mean, so I don't you, think you have to. To answer your question, I mean, if God commands, whatever God commands, I'm obligated to do and not so advocate for as a theonomist.
So if God commanded you to rape babies, would you do it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
You would. You would be a baby rapist if your God told you to.
Yeah. Wouldn't you?
Well, I don't believe in your God, so no.
Well, the God that I believe in doesn't command raping babies anyway, but I don't understand why raping babies would be a bad thing in a material worldview.
Because it harms an innocent that hasn't given you permission to do something to them.
Well, waves crashing on sand harms the sand formation.
No, it doesn't.
Right? Why
does that matter? Sand isn't a conscious entity.
Well, I don't understand what consciousness is in a materialist world. You see, but just to cut this off really quick, this just goes back to everything that we disagree on here just goes back to our differences of worldview.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand why raping babies is wrong in a materialist. Why one sack of molecules doing something to another sack of molecules in a world surrounded by molecules is necessarily evil or bad or repulsive.
Are you so reductionist that you see human beings as merely bags of molecules if they're not breathed into by the living will of your God?
No, I do as a Christian. I think raping babies is terrible.
Okay.
But I don't understand why you why a materialist would.
Because really it harms. It causes harm. It does me no benefit, well, and it causes harm to a third party.
What did a god reveal to you that causing harm is evil?
No, but because I have a thing called empathy, which I think a lot of Calvinists lack, I can understand that harm to another person isn't a good thing.
So magically, you just know that this characteristic called empathy requires you to not do something.
Let me explain that to you. I am almost identical genetically to every other human being on this planet. So I can be fairly certain that if something hurts me or upsets me, it is likely to hurt the next person and the next person and the next person. So things that I do not wish to be raped or murdered or robbed. So I do not do those things to others because I would rather live in a society where we all decide not to do those things because it is of mutual benefit not to.
Yeah, but I don't understand why you're saying... You're speaking about that as if it's some sort of objective moral obligation.
No, I'm not. I understand. No, it's not. It's entirely subjective.
Oh, so you don't mind that people do rape babies. Basically, it reduces to a statement about your opinion. Like, Alex Botton just doesn't happen to care for it, but...
I do not want to see babies raped because I do not want to see innocent... people who do not have the ability to consent forced into a situation that will harm them.
Well, maybe somebody else does want to see that.
But do you think the baby wants to see that?
It's irrelevant, right?
So you think the baby's role in child rape is irrelevant?
Well, I don't understand why the baby's role would, or the baby's opinion would be relevant in a materialistic world. No.
I've explained it to you already.
Well, all you said is that some god has magically revealed to you that harming others is not...
No, I didn't say anything about a god. If you tell me where I said anything about a god, I'd be very interested.
Well, that's my malicious character of your position, because you're basically saying that magically you just know that harming people is wrong. Well, why don't you just arbitrarily decide that harming babies is a good thing?
We have arrived through our evolutionary development as a species, because we live in groups. We are a social species. We have arrived at the point where we know that working altruistically together is of greater benefit to the group as a whole and the individuals within it than working harmfully. So if you've got two groups of individuals, one group that thinks it's fine to murder, steal and rape from each other, and the other that doesn't, the one that's going to survive is the one that doesn't think it's good to do those things, because the other group will murder, rob and steal itself, murder, rob and rape itself to death. It will not continue.
But why worry about survivability? Why is that something that we should care about? In fact, why shouldn't we work for the end of humanity?
Because again,
why should I do what evolution tells? I mean, that you have to understand.
Let me put it this way: do you want to die?
Well, me personally, as a Christian, I think living is a good thing.
You in the head right now?
If I was a materialist, I think I probably would.
So you would kill yourself if you were a materialist?
I wouldn't see a rational reason not to.
So you don't value the life you've got?
I don't understand what value is in a materialist universe.
I find joy and wonder in being alive. I enjoy being alive. I know that everybody else enjoys being alive, I would hope. Some people have horrible times and don't enjoy it, and I think that's a terrible thing. But I think we should work as a species to try and alleviate the suffering of those people. I enjoy being with my wife. My wife enjoys me being alive. I enjoy her being alive. I enjoy my children being alive. I hope my children will live long and happy lives and then go on and have children of their own, because those things make me feel good. I want those things to end. So why is that wrong? Why is my opinion of that wrong?
Well, I don't think your opinion is wrong as a Christian. I think you have a good opinion there. What I object to is the idea that your opinion somehow is binding on the consciences of everyone else, or that your opinion somehow makes moral propositions true or false. The moral, think about it this way: the moral proposition, we should not steal, is not made true or false because of Alex Botton's opinion, right? Alex Botton's opinion is irrelevant to the truth.
No, I agree.
That particular proposition.
Totally agree.
So, yeah, well, that's good then.
But
that's
society, good. I mean, but once you take that opinion up to the level of a society, then that reaches a point where you have laws, where you have these things codified. Yeah. Now, the fact that most countries in the world have laws against murder, rape, and theft, and a whole load of other things that are negative and harmful to us as human beings, shows that as a species, we generally think those things are harmful. It doesn't really make any difference what my opinion is, if the societal opinion obviously shows that my opinion isn't unique.
But do you understand that the truth value of the proposition is not made true or false because of a society's opinion or your opinion or whatever? At best, all you're doing is saying that most people agree with you. That's what the great Bertrand Russell even says in his essay on the good life. He can't say for sure what the good life ought to be. All he can say is what he wants it to be and hopes society agrees with him. So if that's all, I mean, that's what you have. That's what you're reduced to, is a mere assertion of opinion, which you hope everybody agrees with you on.
But the thing is, like, I know that everybody agrees with me.
Well, that's a different
you
topic
agree
to
with
talk
me.
About, but... do I agree with you that
you want to live in a society where people won't harm you, so you agree with me?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The question is, can we rationally justify these beliefs that we have about propositions? You cannot. You just have feelings and opinions that you would like to see. I have rational justifications for it.
And what is your rational justification?
Well, as a Christian, we have God's revelation.
And what form does that take?
I don't know. Well, obviously, if you know anything about Christianity, you know that we believe God revealed himself through various prophets and apostles who have written his word down in the
Bible. So the Bible. Scripture. So you're saying that revelation, is that revelation limited to the Bible?
I don't understand. Let me try to answer that. And what I think you're asking is that I believe everything is a revelation of God, but the Bible just is a special revelation. So in Reformed theology, we distinguish between natural revelation and special revelation, yes.
So just to qualify this, so if I stood up and broke wind into this microphone, would that be a revelation from God?
In a certain way, yeah.
What would God be saying through my fart?
Well, that's the problem with interpreting natural revelation. We can't necessarily...
Could we find somebody who can interpret my fart?
We can't necessarily interpret natural revelation without the aid of special revelation. So what we would be able to determine from your fart is that, various propositions. You're human. You probably eat too much fish and chips. I don't know what you guys eat over there. But, there's a lot of things that we could determine from your fart.
But to get the true meaning of the fart, we'd really need to get a special revelation, maybe looking at the Bible to see what it says about farts.
Absolutely. About anything.
Okay.
Farts.
Are there any verses about farts?
I'm sorry, what?
Are there any verses about farts?
Verses of Scripture?
Yeah.
No, not directly. Okay.
Let
me expound real quick. The Bible is a set of true propositions, and it says right in the Westminster Confession, we take whatever the Bible says as authoritative, plus whatever can be correctly deduced from the propositions is also equally authoritative. So even though the Bible doesn't speak about things like, as Dr. Bronson would always say, curing polio, the Bible does act as our interpreting mechanism for how we determine or interpret natural revelation. So farts, curing polio, playing checkers, whatever, is all interpreted through the lens of Scripture, if you will.
And if one follows through, is there anything in the Bible as to who gets the dry cleaning bill?
We definitely could determine that based on propositions in Scripture, yes.
Excellent. Okay, then. So, I'm assuming that the basis of your belief in the Bible is that you have to assume that your God exists in the first place, or the whole thing's meaningless. Is that right?
I don't understand what you mean by basis or whatever. Okay,
let me rephrase this. If your God didn't exist, would the Bible be meaningless?
Yeah, absolutely. I would affirm that. If God did not exist, then we would not be able to have meaning in symbols. We wouldn't know that a Bible existed. We wouldn't be able to determine that other minds exist to communicate to us. Linguistic acts would be impossible.
No. No, I'm not going to let you get away with that. You're saying that if God didn't exist, the conversation we're having wouldn't be possible. Now, I say that it would be possible because we're having it and God doesn't exist. Now, the Bible obviously does exist, even without the existence of God. And I will prove this. I have a Bible here. This is a Bible. I can prove it's a Bible and just, not just a book. Let me find the opening front page that actually says Bible on it somewhere. Here we go. Here we go. It's my old NIV study Bible from when I was a Christian. This is a Bible. It definitely exists. God doesn't exist, so this does exist. So we can still discuss this book as it exists, even if your God doesn't exist. So would this book cease to have any relevance to life if the character portrayed within its pages is fictitious?
Is it my turn to respond?
Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
Okay, yeah. Well, you made a number of errors just now. I don't know how familiar you are with the philosophical literature, but what you've done is just what philosopher Louis Bonjour calls a naive empirical response. You naively assume that what your eyes are telling you about the world outside of your mind happens to be authoritative and true. But you have no reason to think so. You just expect me to allow you to speak that way, and I'm not kind enough to allow unbelievers who believe in this ridiculous fairy tale of materialism and whatever else. I mean, pardon the pejorative term there. I'm just kind of playing around a little bit. Well, but you have to understand that in philosophical circles, skepticism is taken very seriously. So you can't just arbitrarily claim that because your eyes see something that therefore it's truth. We don't let you get away with that.
But I did go through. Command... I mean, I know that from your comments in the threads below the discussion with Ted that you were aware of the conversation I was having with him. I went through how I know that this wooden owl exists, and I went through the various processes. And as I said to Ted, if those processes are correct, then I know what I know about this object.
So, I agree with you there.
So if those processes are correct, which we can then go through them and we can measure them and check them in the lab to see if they are correct.
Yes, absolutely.
And we can independently corroborate them. So we can say authoritatively that all the processes I described to getting to the end result of knowing that I have this in my hand are empirically true. I know what I know. So,
let me just cut in here because what you said is correct as far as it goes. For instance, Christians, we're often asked how we know that we're not in an insane asylum right now instead of having a conversation. So if our empirical sense perceptions are authoritative about a world outside of our mind, then we would be able to use them to verify their authority. So we have things like experiments that demonstrate repeatability. We can use other empirical methods to verify different empirical methods. So you can do that. The question is, and I think philosopher William Alston points this out very well in his book on the reliability of sense perceptions, you can only demonstrate that your sense perceptions are reliable using empirical means if you first know that your sense perceptions are reliable. So that's what we Christians have that you don't, is that we have an externalist mechanism to where we know that our sense perceptions are reliable. You do not. So
yeah, I do.
That's a major skeptical problem. No, you don't. I mean, with all due respect, you don't, because all you have
is... With all due respect, I do.
All you have is a vicious circle of I prove my empirical senses with my empirical senses, and that's a vicious circle. It's not rational.
The externalist verification is evolutionary necessity. We have had to evolve these senses.
You're an externalist. You're an externalist. Interesting.
But you are. You're demanding... Well, because you're demanding... this is what presuppositionists do, and this is what I said to Ted. You demand an internalist verification, an internalist justification for knowledge from the non-believer, whilst relying on an externalist verification yourself and denying your opponent an externalist verification.
Now,
your externalist... Your externalist verification is your God, and you cannot prove this being exists.
Well, we can prove God exists, but that's a separate conversation than what we're having right now. What I want to do right now is get you to verify this. Let's just take a step back really quick. I don't want to ask you for an internal justification while I play the externalist game. I don't want to do that. So if you want to be an externalist, that's great. Now we're going to have to deal with planning. I mean, so assuming you reject the idea of internalist justification, now you're going to have to move into some sort of ideal of warrant. And as we all know from reading the great Alvin Plantinga, we're going to have some sort of conceptual analysis of what it means for our cognitive faculties to function properly, and I don't think you can do that given a naturalist worldview.
Evolutionary necessity gives me enough confidence that my cognitive apparatus is functioning properly. Within my world, that is adequate enough for me to feel that I am justified in what I know. So how do you justify
it? Does it magically happen? You do know that proper function requires minds and intentionality. That's one of the major arguments that Alvin Plantinga makes, and I think is so good.
To be honest, Scott, I don't give a rat's ass what Plantinga thinks.
Okay, well,
I'm just telling you what I think. Now, I am quite happy with my justification for what I know. Within my worldview, that satisfies me, and that accounts for my knowledge to my satisfaction. So, let me finish.
We're not talking about psychological assurity.
The question that would come from the presuppositionist would be, how do you account for your knowledge? Now, I have given how I, Alex Watson, account for my knowledge claims. So how do you, Scott Terry, account for yours?
Well, you've given a fairy tale version by
saying
that irrelevant
of whether I have or not, that is my view and that satisfies me within my worldview. So now explain your worldview and tell me how your knowledge is gained.
Well, I mean, if you just want to not have your worldview critiqued and you just want to go on to critique mine, that's fine, I guess. But
I
just want to point out that
am I not allowed to ask you how yours is?
Oh, you certainly can if you want to change the topic. I mean, you claim to be able to prove that the Bible existed, and you didn't give us a reason. You just said you basically believe evolution helps you do it, but I don't understand what a naturalist account of proper function would be.
Do you agree that I'm holding a Bible?
I do, yes.
Corroboration. Well, there we go. I'm holding a Bible. Let's move on from that then. So you
but
agree
how do you
that
know
I'm holding
that
a Bible?
Corroborated?
Because you just said you have. Are you lying to me?
Well, I mean, how do you know that your ears are correctly delivering to you information about Scott Terry?
Evolutionary necessity. So let's go on to the next point. How do you justify your knowledge?
We can talk about how I justify knowledge.
Yes, please do. I'm asking you that.
But I don't understand how you can have proper function in a naturalist position.
Not my problem.
Well, it is problem.
My worldview is consistent and I live by it. So let's hear your justification for knowledge.
You're basically just arbitrarily asserting that you have knowledge, and that's fine if that's
live. I've gone through the processes that satisfy my need to understand how I gain knowledge. Now do the same for me.
No, I mean, I don't think you have. You're just saying that you have. I mean, you have to see this from my perspective.
Wood an owl, photons bounce off the owl through the eye, processes generate an image of an owl, various other senses, pressure, weight, etc., smell, taste, give me a picture of what I'm holding. If all those different elements are true, I am holding an owl. There you go, that's my account. Tell me yours.
That account would only work if you are in an environment that is conducive for that sort of thing to begin with. That's the first thing you have to have.
Because I wouldn't be able to do it without that. Now, you may say that's begging the question, but I frankly don't care. I have accounted for my knowledge within my worldview. Please account for yours.
Well, you haven't, and I'm trying to explain to you why.
No, but I have. To my satisfaction, I have. For you to say I haven't is irrelevant. I want you now to explain your route to knowledge.
I just know. I mean, if we're going to play this game, then I can play the game too. I mean, therefore it's consistent.
I'm not going to
let me finish. Let me just lay out really quick the Plantinga model here. You need to be in an environment that is conducive to truth, right? You can't be on another planet somewhere where photons bouncing off of objects somehow does not work. I mean, if your eyes aren't correctly attuned for catching these protons, then you can't have that knowledge. So you have to be in the proper environment. But that's not a big problem for us because we all pretty much agree we're in the correct environment that's conducive for knowing things. But you have to have also a properly functioning cognitive faculty, right, that is designed, that functions according to a design plan that's conducive for knowledge. If you don't have that, then even if your eyes deliver to you sensations, you don't know if your cognitive faculties are properly functioning in such a way to deliver to you a perceptual knowledge about a world outside of your own mind.
Do you know, though,
the account that you've...
Every day that I go through my life not dying proves that I'm correct in my cognitive modeling.
But not dying is just another empirical perception you think you're having.
So you think I might be dead?
I don't think so as a Christian, but I can prove it as a Christian. I don't understand how you get around it as a non-Christian in this materialist view, because you don't have a concept of proper function that relies on a design plan. Now, by the way, there's been various secular atheist philosophers who have tried to formulate a naturalist materialist idea of what a proper function would be, and that's what Alvin Plantinga devotes his entire book, Warrant and Proper Function, to trying to go through, survey them, show why they all fail, and I don't think any secular philosophers come up with a way to describe what it means for something to properly function without alluding to a person, without alluding to a designer.
Now, you may be, I don't know if maybe the cognitive abilities, Scott, but you may remember that I said that I didn't give the rear parts of a rodent that's bigger than a mouse but smaller than a kind of large shrew. I didn't give that about Plantinga, and I wanted to know what your route to knowledge is. So you have tried to avoid this. I've explained what my route is, and it satisfies me within my worldview, and I live by it every day, and I successfully live by it every day. So that is fine for me. It works. So please explain to me how you gain knowledge.
Okay. Well, excuse me. I do not mind discussing Christian apologetics.
Well, do
Christian
so then,
epistemology.
Please.
I really don't. But I just want to make it clear that. I'm not dodging.
Yes, you are.
I don't know how much time you have, but I don't mind.
I've got as long as it takes.
Actually, I do not. I'll have to leave in about, what time is it? At any rate, I just want to point out that what you've done is basically just arbitrarily say, I'm okay with not having a good ideal of proper function. I'm okay with not knowing anything.
That's not what I said at all. But if you want to straw my own position that way, then that's absolutely fine. Reflects more on you than
please.
It does on me. Please explain to me
please
how you gain knowledge.
Well, if you can demonstrate that you're having a conversation right now without arbitrarily assuming it, then I'd be happy to. But
are
I don't
you
like.
Avoiding,
little...
Are you now avoiding telling me how you gain knowledge?
Are you claiming that your sense perceptions are delivering to you true information about Scott Terry and what he may or may not be doing? I mean, I don't think
as far as I can see, I am getting information from the monitor of my screen via vibrating membranes in earphones that travel through into that send vibrations into my ears. Various pieces of information that I'm getting through my senses are telling me that somebody who claims to be called Scott Terry is talking to me via a Google Hangout on my computer. So please explain to me how you gain knowledge.
How do you know your sense perceptions, or I'm sorry, how do you know your cognitive faculties are properly functioning?
Scott, do you not understand the question I'm asking you? I'll ask you again.
I do understand.
Please explain to me.
I do understand your question.
Well, tell me then.
Well, it's just, it's just, I guess.
You can't.
Well, I can, certainly. I read
books
all the
please.
Time on. Well, here's the thing.
Well, explain how you gain knowledge. You should be able to do this. If you are receiving this knowledge from the creator of the universe, that it is being revealed to you in such a way that you can know
yeah.
it, you should be able to tell me like that. So tell me.
Well, I can tell you like that, but first of all,
do
we're
then.
Critiquing
I'm asking
your,
you to.
I know, but we're critiquing your position.
No, we're not.
You just
we're
arbitrarily...
asking you to explain how you gain knowledge. Tell me.
So you would like to move from your position to a critique of my position.
I don't know if you've been listening for the last 15 minutes, but I've been asking you to explain.
Well, hey, settle down, settle down. There's no need for you to get the fangs out.
I'm not getting the fangs out.
Okay, there's no need for you to get the fangs out. We can discuss your position like we started to, and then we can move on to my position. But for now, I don't...
I'm satisfied with it.
Well, maybe you can explain it to me again, because I don't seem to understand how you can be internally justified and how you can have... proper function, because it just seems to me you're just arbitrarily asserting it.
So if you would like to have an internal justification.
No, if you would just
you said
you don't
that a
get
moment
rid,
ago, didn't you?
You don't get rid of the idea of justification just by appealing to externalist accounts of justification. You still have to have justification.
I have explained to you that I am justified within my worldview. So please explain to me within your worldview how you gain knowledge.
Well, you haven't explained it very
yes,
well.
Yes, I have, because my worldview, the worldview of Alex Botton, what I have explained adequately explains it for you. That is how I account for it. That accounts for it within my worldview. I don't care about anybody else's worldview, but within my worldview it accounts for it. So, shoot,
so
your
you
worldview, please.
It doesn't, though.
Yes,
let
it
me,
does.
Let me just state
but it's
this.
My worldview.
So
you claim to know what my
you believe that. You believe that photons bouncing off of objects... come back to your eyeballs, right? And that your eyeballs deliver those sensations to your brain in such a way that your brain can gather these sensations together and form perceptions, and that the perceptions you form together, that your faculties form these perceptions together to form concepts about the perceptions. What I'm asking you is, I don't understand. I mean, you say that that just magically works, but no, I don't understand that. How
you
that...
said it just magically works. I said that we could go to a lab and test every step of it. So go on. I would really like you to explain how you gain knowledge. Why are you dodging that?
Well, I'm not dodging it.
Yes, you are, because you're not telling me.
First of all, you don't know what I am or am not doing, because everything you think you know could just be a malfunction of your cognitive faculties, because you don't have anything like a proper function, an idea of proper function.
But if that's the case, then you do not exist. It doesn't do anything to help your argument. So please explain how you gain knowledge.
Well, it helps my argument because you're not able
Scott Terry, you're dodging now, and everybody can see you.
I'm not dodging.
Yes, you are. You could be renamed Dodger Terry.
I'm sorry. Well, look, I already told you that if we're going to play this arbitrary game... Well, I just know. I just know what I know.
Is that how you
know? That's enough for me. I've justified it there.
Okay, so you just know, and I can explain it. So I can explain it through various empirically testable means, and you just know. So how is my position weaker than yours?
Well, I explained my position through various empirically testable means as well.
Okay, so you agree with me?
No, I as a Christian am an empiricist.
Okay, so what do you do that's different?
I have a God that sets up an environment such that I have properly functioning cognitive faculties.
Okay, and what evidence? What evidence do you have on this
blind
God?
Nature.
Also, what evidence do you have of this God?
Okay, just to be clear now, we're moving from a conversation about a warrant, and we're moving into a conversation about proof.
Just to be clear, you have made an assertion. I want you to back it up. What evidence do you have for your God?
Well, you made the assertion that the Bible exists, but you haven't proven that yet. You just arbitrarily asserted it. So if that's the game we're going to play...
Book in my hand, photons, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Come on
now.
Tell me how you do your knowledge.
Listen, I'm going to be studying sophisticated atheist philosophers, and I do look at sophisticated atheist accounts to try to figure out how they come up with... ideals of proper function. You're just ignoring the question because I don't think you've ever studied it. I don't think you're prepared to talk about it, but I don't want to speculate about it.
Clearly, the one that's not prepared to talk about it is yourself. Now, will you please tell me how you gain knowledge through your worldview?
I just think that's a disingenuous question given that...
How is that a disingenuous question?
Well, I've answered it. You've answered it. We're both playing the arbitrary assertion game. So
I'm not.
How is that... Yes, you are. You won't tell me how you can know what you know.
I have told you. Just because it doesn't satisfy you makes no difference to me.
It's not that it doesn't satisfy me psychologically. It doesn't satisfy me psychologically. What it doesn't do is logically work out, because you don't know that your cognitive faculties are properly functioning. I do.
I test mine every day by crossing the road, by walking down the stairs.
You don't understand.
Picking up various things that are hot. I understand it because I successfully negotiate the world in which I find myself. Now, that is enough for me.
Okay.
Tell me how you gain knowledge.
Well, wait a minute.
Stop dodging, Scott Terry.
You have to have a conversation.
And tell me how you gain knowledge.
Let me ask you this. If I say the Bible is true because the Bible is true, you would say, hold on, that's viciously circular. That's a fallacy.
No, I would say to you, provide evidence to back up your assertion.
Wait, if we state this out formally, X because of X, would that not be a fallacy?
Law of non-contradiction, you say that the Bible is true because the Bible is true because you think it applies, you think it fits with the law of non-contradiction.
I'm not saying that. I'm offering an illustration. If I say X is true because X is true, that will be a tautology. It'll be begging the question, right?
Okay.
If you say my sense perceptions are accurate because my sense perceptions are accurate, you're making a tautology. Well, it is. You say that you justify your sense perceptions because of your sense perceptions.
I've said that my senses are obviously giving me broadly correct information because I successfully negotiate.
Because the word obvious implies that you're using your
sense
perceptions.
Because I successfully negotiate
success
the environment I find myself in. I've given
the word
you my
success.
Tell me how you gain knowledge, please.
Okay. Okay, well, your reason is your sense perceptions are accurate because you've tested them with your sense perceptions.
No, that's fine, not what I've said, but if that's what you want to go with. Okay, I mean, if you want to, I can. If you want to, I can go through your position. I'm assuming you ascribe to the tag as as your form of presuppositionalism. Is that correct?
You're not allowed to. I'm not going to allow you to critique my position until you can actually prove
convenient.
That somebody called Scott. Well, look.
That's really convenient, isn't it, Scott? So, let me ask you a question. If this is
it's convenient for me.
If this is an apologetic that's designed to shut the mouths of your opponent, it doesn't work very well, does it?
Well, I've basically got you to admit that you're just a naive, blind faith empiricist, and that's good enough
haven't.
For me.
No, you haven't. And you provided no evidence that your position is any good. Do you actually believe in God? Or are you just
Alex
a racist,
Biden,
homophobe misogynist who just shackles that to your God belief?
Oh, don't look. Put the claws up, kitten. If you believe in your sense perceptions because they're successful, that is another word for believing in sense perception because of the accuracy of sense perceptions. That's what successful means. You cannot appeal to things like success. You cannot appeal to things like experiments. You cannot appeal to any other sort of empirical verification to justify empirical investigation to begin with. That's what I don't agree with. That's what I don't understand. But if that's the position you want to take, that's fine.
Do I take it that you are unwilling to provide evidence to support your position?
I don't know. Can you prove that you're having a conversation? No,
because
you can't.
If
no, you can't. You're helpless in front of a presuppositionalist. You're helpless to defy the Christian God, and this is why atheism
but
will
you
never
haven't
fail.
Even
this is why Christianity.
But you are refusing to use your argument. You are refusing to even deploy your presuppositionalism. Mm. You're refusing to even tell me how you gain knowledge. How do you gain knowledge?
That's fine. As Christians, we'll move on from this now because I don't want to get
no,
stuck up.
No, we won't because I want you to tell me how we define how
I'm
you
saying,
know things.
Yeah, I'm saying we'll move on into that. We'll move on into my position if you
would
like, because I think I've adequately shown that you're helpless on that position. So as everyone knows, well, you can't prove it, can you? Without naively believing in your sense perception. But
at
any
rate, 5 years old, Scott Harry.
No, I'm doing what's called poning an arrogant atheist.
Are you?
I think it's fun. Here's what we do. Here's what we do as presuppositionalists. As I'm sure you're aware, we have what's called the two-step method. The first step, there's not really any order to it, but one step is to do an internal critique of the unbeliever's system, which is we've just done. And now the second step is to invite you into our worldview to show that on our worldview we do have things like theories of proper function based on a design plan.
Well,
so
firstly, tell me, you obviously have to believe in your God. What evidence do you have this God exists?
Well, I don't. What do you mean? Obviously, have to believe in God. Are you saying that for presuppositionalism to properly function, that we have to believe in God?
What purpose would it serve if you didn't believe in God? Would it just be because purely it would be nothing but just a bully boy tactic to argue otherwise, wouldn't it?
Let me phrase it this way, so I think we can get closer to what you're saying. Because I want to scratch where you're itching. Presuppositionalists, or just Christians in general, we're empiricists within a Christian framework. So we know what we know about the objects outside of our mind because we empirically sense them, things like chairs, things like Alex Botton's, things like trees or whatever.
Exactly the same way as I do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, we're all made in God's image, so we all operate the same way, yeah.
Are we physically made in God's image, or are we spiritually made in His image?
That's a big question that would really take... I've done a little bit of work on that, but I don't know if... Do you want to get off into that, or...
Well, no, it's just a brief aside, because also at that same point, he says, let us make man in our image. Who's he referring to in the plural?
Well, we take that as the Trinity, but the debates about what it means to be made in God's image are complex in Christian theology, but the Reformed position, the Reformed community usually holds that God's image is something like our rationality, our dominion. It's more of a legal position, a standing, if you will.
So mankind doesn't look like God.
Well, God is not material to have a physical image to reflect light to and shape and all
is,
of that. So.
Is your God omnipotent and omniscient?
We use those terms in Christian theology to explicate certain theological truths in shorthand. I mean, that's why these words were invented by the medieval theologians to help us so that we don't have to write out the full meaning each time what we mean.
Okay. Can your God? Could your God create knowledge that didn't yet exist?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the.
Could your God create something? Create a piece of knowledge that he didn't yet know.
A piece of? Are you asking? Could God create a true proposition that?
No.
Is not
no. What I'm saying is, could God generate some knowledge that didn't yet exist that he didn't previously know? Could he then come up with something that he didn't know beforehand?
I don't know what a piece of knowledge.
Well,
like what an object. Are you saying
concept,
an object?
An idea, something that he did not know before. Could he then generate knowledge about something that he did not know before he generated that knowledge?
Classically speaking, no. God already knows. God already has all of his thoughts.
So he can't.
Classically,
he can't generate new knowledge.
No.
So he's not omnipotent then.
Well, I don't know what you mean by omnipotent.
All-powerful, able to do everything within his power.
I would reject that understanding.
Does he lack the does he lack the power to create new knowledge?
I don't understand what it means to create new knowledge.
Could he create something that previously did not conceptually exist, that he did not know about before he created it?
Well, he can't create something he's never known about, but he can create all sorts of objects that have never existed before, sure.
But would he have to know about them?
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
let me boil this down. You're trying to ask, is God...
Does that not put you into an infinite regress in both directions, that he has to know everything about an eternal timeline?
Well, it seems convenient that we just happen to have a God that knows everything.
Prove it.
Well, that's a different question.
Does he know everything?
So now what you want to do is move from an internal critique of Christianity to asking if is Christianity itself true.
No,
that's fine.
I'm not even talking about Christianity. I'm talking about the concept of a God as laid out by your belief system. Plenty of people believe in that. Well, plenty of people believe in Yahweh in different forms,
yeah.
But they believe that he has certain traits. Now, how would Yahweh know that he is omniscient?
Well, that's an incoherent question from a Christian perspective. Yeah, it is. Well, if we take someone like a Van Inwagen's view of what coherence is, it means something is coherent if it doesn't. If two propositions are coherent if they do not imply a contradiction, and the question you ask implies a contradiction, so it's incoherent from a Christian perspective.
Surely, as I pointed out to Ted, a being could believe it knew everything and could tell lesser beings that it knew everything, but in fact it didn't, and could have a superior being above it going, ha ha ha, look at Yahweh, he thinks he knows everything.
Yeah.
Do you
accept
that could happen?
Well, not in a Christian conception, but yes, that's a good critique of certain generic theistic positions, I'm
sure.
Why
is it not possible for Yahweh to be a lesser being subject to a greater being that actually knows more than him?
Well, if you're going to take Christianity for granted, that's just the kind of system you're going to have to deal with, is the kind of system where that can't happen.
So, you're saying it can't happen, but you have nothing to back up the assertion that it can't happen.
Well, keep in mind, you're just basically asking me, is Christianity true?
No, I'm asking
you. And if Christianity is...
No, I'm asking
yes, you.
You
are.
No, we've not even got to that point. I'm asking
well,
you
actually,
if the
you
being...
Have. You actually
I'm asking
have.
You if the being that you believe in can in any way be able to express its own knowledge of its own omniscience without externally checking that omniscience? And is it possible that that being is actually a lower god below a further up one that's going, ha ha ha, I've made Yahweh think he knows everything. He's going around creating a universe, telling everybody he knows everything. What a cosmic joke God is.
That question... I know you don't understand how at this point because I haven't pointed it out to you, but that question ultimately reduces to a mere question of is Christianity true or not, and I can prove that through a series of arguments, but I think the best way to approach it will be, I know you're familiar with my trickster God article that I posted. And this basically is the same argument. So what I like to do is classify arguments like this and call them – by the way, this is what I think all philosophers ought to do, is to try to classify arguments and try to categorize things to make it simple or at least less complex for us. But what I like to do is call all of this class of arguments fallacious de facto arguments. So ultimately, it's a formally invalid argument that you're trying to make. If you were to take the time to structure it formally, you would see that it fails. Look,
we are going to save ourselves 10 minutes here, because I have read your article about the tricks to God. And what you do is you concentrate in on the argument itself in forms of its logical construction, a construction that you then put forward. But you don't actually address whether the reality of it is the case or not at any point. How would you know that you were not being fooled by a being? In fact, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this question.
Well, you just asked, okay.
Is your God able to change your thoughts without you realizing it?
Well, let me just take a step back here, because
answer my question. Yes or no?
Well, I'm going to take the liberty to answer your question however I'd like, if that's okay.
I'd like a yes or a no, because it would make it
if you want somebody to answer questions,
if I want somebody to answer questions, I probably need to get somebody else, don't I, Scott?
Oh yeah, or get somebody that, like, a Sunday school child or something that would probably be more your caliber. If you want a real Christian answer, I'll tell you the answer to the question. You admitted earlier that I haven't, in my article, talked about the truth of the situation. That's correct. That's correct. Mm-hmm. The truth is, if Christianity were true, then there is no God outside of God forcing God to believe things. If Christianity were true, there would be no trickster God. So all of these sorts of fallacious de facto arguments reduce to simple questions about the truth of Christianity. And if that's all you want to ask, then we can just go into, like, the transcendental argument. I mean, that's where we are there.
Well, I mean, you've still not actually explained how you gain knowledge properly by your God. But...
Well, you haven't either.
No, I have.
You haven't either, so if you want to play that game again, we could just get right back into it.
But, okay. Do you honestly think that you're making a good case for
I know I am.
Given that you've already pretty much thrown Banson under the bus by admitting he was a colossal homophobe... because that's not going to fly well with the moderate Christians. So I don't think that's going to bring the moderate Christians to your point of view.
I'm interested in the truth. I don't really care what moderate Christians would think.
But you obviously are, because you keep on bringing up various other philosophers and stuff. So you're obviously interested in what other people think.
I'm interested in what they think, but I'm not concerned with polemics to try to win people over. That's not my job as a Calvinist.
But I thought you said that this argument is a polemic. You said that right at the start of our discussion. But you now just said that you're not interested in polemics. So which is it? Are you interested in them or not interested in them?
It's a polemic, but it's not a meant to persuade, right?
Sounds quite contradictory to me.
Well, it's not contradictory. What we as Christians...
You've just told me that you it's not a polemic, and you said earlier that it is, and then it isn't. And
try to distinguish between these two points. One, winning people over emotionally. Or two, winning an argument rationally and silencing the foolish talk of unbelief. Those are two different enterprises. I'm trying to do the latter, not the former. Yeah, which I have, because you've just basically admitted you have blind faith in your sense perception. Yeah, so I've kind of laughed, chuckled. Well, you haven't admitted it, but that's what you said, basically.
No, it isn't what I said, is it, though? If you're reduced to strawmanning my position, then your argument's obviously quite weak.
Oh, please, don't. Stand on ceremony, correct me.
But I've already gone through it. I'm not going to go through it.
Oh, okay.
It's not my problem if you weren't listening.
I was listening. I heard you say that you judge the reliability of your sense perceptions based on things like success, which is itself a...
I tested against my survivability, yes. I tested against how successfully I survive in the environment I find myself in. If I successfully survive, then I can be confident that my sense information is giving me correct data.
Successful survivability is an empirical observation, as I'm sure you're aware. Because you're alluding to empirical observations to justify empirical observations, which is logically fallacious. X does not prove X. You can't, you wouldn't let me get away with saying the Bible's true because the Bible says it's true.
But you believe the Bible is true because the Bible says it's true, don't you?
Well, that's not why I believe the Bible is true. I have a sophisticated transcendental argument.
Well, because it's a sophisticated argument, then.
Yeah. Let's get Alex Button off the hot seat and turn it back on.
I'm not on the hot seat. That seat I'm on, I'll show you. is actually quite cool. It's quite a cool seat that I'm sitting on.
Yeah. After the farts that you're...
Yeah.
Well, you didn't really fart, though, hopefully.
No.
But you did
talk about farts quite a long time, which was quite funny, I thought.
Well, given the context of the conversation, I think it's apt, but...
Oh, so are you now reduced to just insulting me because of frustration?
I'm not frustrated.
You sound quite frustrated.
I do.
You do sound frustrated.
Okay. Well, I forgot that one of the magical powers atheists have is reading people's emotions. But let's get back to the conversation. You're asking me again how you want... You asked me about the trickster God argument or what you call a God outside of God. I refuted that, and now you want to move on and talk about the truth of Christianity itself.
You didn't refute it, though, did you?
I didn't refute it. I demonstrated that it just reduces to a simple question of, is Christianity true?
No, you asserted that it isn't true. You asserted...
I'm interested to hear what
you
think. You
didn't answer a very key question about it, which was, can your God change your thoughts without you realizing it, yes or no?
He has the power to, but it's not something that he does.
He did that to the Pharaoh. He hardened the Pharaoh's heart when the Pharaoh wanted to let the children of Israel leave Egypt. So he obviously
didn't change Pharaoh's thoughts.
Yes, he
changed his heart.
He changed his mind. Oh, do you think people think with their hearts, Scott?
Well, yeah, that's where all of our thoughts come from. And
from our hearts.
From is our will.
They come physically from our hearts.
That's a poetic way of speaking about the nature, obviously, of course. We have in Christian anthropology an idea that our will determines what we think.
Does our thoughts originate in our brain?
I'm sorry, does what?
Does the will originate in the brain?
That's a complicated question. We would have to get into Christian anthropology, which I'm fine to do.
Christian anthropology.
If you'd like to move there. Yeah.
No, I'm just wanting you to tell me a simple answer. Can your God, because I've just pointed out that there is an example where your God has done this, and if your God can do this, how do you know that this has not happened to you?
First of all, it has happened to me, but God
has
regenerated my heart.
So he has changed your thoughts without you realizing?
Yeah, he hasn't changed my thoughts, he's changed my will, which I've tried to tell you that in Christianity we distinguish between a person's will and the thoughts that are generated by the will. If you don't like that, that's fine. If you'd like to present an argument against that or something, I understand. But
so do you think the will and thoughts are different things?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. How can you will... Well, anyway, I want to scratch where you're itching, but...
I'm not itching
anyway. I mean, if you want to get into the... again, another metaphor here... But, yeah, please distinguish. If you're going to critique Christianity, critique actual Christianity. We distinguish between a person's will and a person's thoughts. Pharaoh did not have a thought that God said, nope, I'm going to take that thought out and put a new thought into your mind. He didn't violate Pharaoh
in that
way.
He clearly did. He wanted to let the children of Israel leave Egypt. Mm. That was his will and his thoughts. And God changed them.
Oh, careful now. Was it his will or his thought?
He willed to let them go because he was suffering at their hands. So he wanted them to go.
His will changed. God changes his will.
So God changed his will without... Okay, let's ask you this way. Could God change your will without you realizing it?
He does all the time, but not without us realizing it.
So how can you know anything if your thoughts and will can be changed at the whim of a supernatural being?
Well, again,
how do you even know that you're having a conversation with me?
Because it's empirical. I can see it happening.
But your God could be beaming this into your head right now, and you could just be lying on your porch, knocked out unconscious from the wind, knocking something into your head.
Well, that's quite a different argument than saying that God changes our wills. God can change our wills all the time without deceiving us. You're asking now, can God be deceiving me? And no, he's not. He could. He has the power, but he doesn't do that.
But he does deceive people, doesn't he, in the Bible?
No.
Yes, he does.
Through a series of second causes, he causes people to be deceived.
So
there are such things as liars, but God does not directly cause anybody to be deceived in an epistemically relevant way.
You can't prove
that from Scripture.
If I hire a hitman to murder somebody, am I completely innocent of that murder?
If you hire a hitman to kill somebody, are you completely innocent of the murder? No.
If I instruct somebody else to do something on my behalf and don't actually do the act myself, am I innocent of that act?
I don't know. It depends on the context.
So if I said within your Christian theocracy that I had paid somebody to go and take out somebody I didn't like, and I said, here you go, I'm going to give you some money, I want you to go and kill that person, am I innocent of that crime?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, if I tell somebody to go and tell a lie on my behalf, am I the liar or is that person the liar?
That person's the liar.
Right, okay, even though I've instructed them to tell a lie.
Yeah.
Does the lie originate with me?
I don't understand the question.
You don't understand the question. It's convenient you don't understand the question, isn't it?
Well, listen, let me state it out for you this way. A lie is a linguistic act, so the lie did not originate with philosophy.
I said, here we go again, because you're just dodging and fluffing again.
Well, I guess if answering your question is dodging, then I guess I'm a dodger.
Yeah, but you're coming up with some
BS answer. Let me make the question. Okay.
Doesn't actually answer the question because in one case you have already said that if I pay somebody to go and kill somebody and I don't do it, then I'm guilty. But if I ask somebody else to go and lie on my behalf, which then has harm to somebody else, I'm not guilty of that. But the only reason I'm not guilty of that is because you know your God does that, and you have to twist it in such a way that your God remains absolutely blood free with his hands, because he cannot lie because of your theology, when clearly in the Bible he makes people lie on his behalf. What about when he sends a deluding spirit to fool people, or sends a strong delusion on people?
That's not
even using somebody else.
First of all, the situation between you hiring somebody to lie and God sovereignly ordaining people to lie is not analogous. So it's not epistemically relevant that people can lie to me. Yes, people lie all the time. There are deceiving spirits. That doesn't mean that this epistemological argument you're trying to make is going to operate. I'll tell you why. This is just another form of the argument from evil, basically, is what it reduces to. And here's why. Suppose a person... God sovereignly ordains everything, right? But God is not responsible for all the sin. So God sovereignly ordains lies, but God's not ethically responsible for the lie, and he's not epistemologically responsible for the lie either in a relevant way that would make...
He generates the lie, but it's not his fault.
If by generate you mean he sets into motion a series of complex second causes... Then I guess he generates it. But if we set it up that way, it's no longer epistemologically relevant, is it? That's the problem you're going to have if you want to make this argument work.
Would the lie have happened if God didn't want it to?
Nothing would happen if God didn't want it to.
Mm. That's not answering the question, though, is it? We're talking specifically about the lie. Would the lie have happened if God didn't want the lie to happen?
The lie is a class of everything that happens, and God is responsible in an ontological way for everything that happens.
God's responsible for the lie.
In an ontological way, not in a legal, ethical way, or in a way that makes him epistemologically, or that makes Christian theology epistemologically vulnerable to this kind of question that you're trying to ask. I mean, what you're trying to say is that Christians can't know anything because God could be lying to us.
Yes.
And that's just... But as I've shown in my article, that's just a reduction. Fancy way of saying that Christianity's false. If that's all you're willing to do, then who cares?
All you've shown in your article is that certain forms of argument you don't believe are valid. Now, tell me, how do you know you're not being lied to by your God right now?
Because Christianity's true.
Yeah, but even if Christianity is true, your God could still be lying to you. So, because we've got evidence that he does, according to your Bible. No, he can.
We have evidence
deluding
that lying
spirits,
exists.
Sending lying spirits upon people, sending delusions on people. How do you know you're not being deluded by God right now?
Because God doesn't delude people in that way.
In the Bible, people it clearly says people. That he sends delusions, strong delusions upon people. How do you know that you've not got a strong delusion sent upon you right now?
How do I know I'm not being lied to by a person?
No, that's not what I said. Listen to what I said.
Well, that's
how. No,
I know
shush,
what you said,
listen,
but I'm rephrasing.
But you
what
don't.
If you condescend to me and tell me to shush one more time, I'm done with this interview.
You're gonna run away.
You're gonna talk to me. I'm gonna run in fear from somebody who acts like a condescending jerk.
But you won't answer my question.
We're gonna.
I'm asking you a simple question. Let me just re-ask the question and just. Okay, let me rephrase the question for you.
Okay. How, I'm gonna give you one more question.
You accept that your God can send strong delusions on people, because the Bible says that's the case. How do you know you are currently not under a strong delusion sent by your God?
Do you mean, how do I know I'm not being tricked by a spirit right now?
How do you know that you are... No. Listen to the words I'm saying in the sentences they form.
I listen to the words.
How do you know that you are not under a strong delusion at the moment that has been sent by your God?
I don't understand what you mean there.
That's convenient.
Because obviously that's not biblical. So what you need to do, what you're trying to say is that God can send angels to lie to us. And you think that that somehow is an epistemological problem for Christianity. What I want you to do is look up a verse of scripture really quick that you think...
2 Thessalonians 2:11. 2 Thessalonians 2:11. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so they will believe the lie. How do you know you are not being sent a powerful delusion to believe a lie right now?
Why don't you read the context?
What would that change the nature of this particular verse?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It wouldn't change the nature of the verse. It would change the nature of your understanding of it. I think it would help you understand the Bible a little bit better if you read the whole, like, in context, instead of just trying to cherry-pick gotcha verses. What you'll see is that people's hearts in an unregenerate state are lead them, like yourself, to gnash their teeth at God and to suppress his truth with lies. A delusional spirit. That's how we could take 2 Thessalonians. I'm sorry if you don't like the answer, but
concerning 2 Thessalonians 2, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered to him, we ask you, brothers and sisters, not to become easily unsettled or alarmed by the teachings allegedly from us, whether by a prophecy or by word of mouth or by letter, asserting that the day of the Lord has already come. Do not let anybody deceive you in this way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. Don't you remember that when I was with you, I used to tell you these things, and now you know that you know what is holding him back, so that he may be revealed at the proper time. For the secret power of the lawlessness is already at work, but the one who now holds it back will continue to do so till he is taken out of the way, and then the lawless one will be revealed. Will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus Christ will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy the splendor of his coming. The coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with how Satan works. He will use all sorts of displays of power through signs and wonders that serve us, and refuse to, and all the ways that the wickedness deceives those who are perishing. They perish because they refuse to love the truth and are so saved. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so that they will believe the lie, and so that all will be condemned who have not believed the truth but have delighted in wickedness. That doesn't change the context at all.
Well, it does. It means that there's wicked men that God's going to send to deceive people.
How do you
and
know?
That what we need to do is love the truth and rely on his revealed revelation. That's what we were talking about earlier when I was talking about special revelation versus natural revelation. We can determine the correct interpretation of natural revelation, which includes, by the way, false prophets and things of that sort, spirits, even if an angel comes to us and teaches us a lie, we can determine that these are lies because of his special revelation, which does not lie.
But this strong delusion, people will believe the lie. How do you know you're not under that strong delusion?
Because I love truth. Remember reading that verse a little bit earlier?
I'm sure that those people thought they loved truth as well.
Oh, well, no, they don't. They know that they don't.
Oh, do you know that?
You know that you don't.
I know that God is a very good thing.
I don't think you do at all. I think you suppress his truth with lies.
So why do you think? What do you think I'm suppressing?
You're suppressing the truth of God. You know God exists.
God exists.
Yeah, you do.
No, I don't.
I think you do.
And I'm willing to stake my life on it.
Well, you actually are. You're staking
your eternal life. And I'm conscious of that. I am conscious of that, and I am so confident that God does not exist that I am consciously staking my life on it. I would say that shows a fair level of confidence in the fact that I don't believe in it.
Okay, but you do understand that if Christianity were true, then you are suppressing his truth.
No.
You understand that's what we believe, right?
No. Now, do you understand that that's a misreading of that verse in Romans?
No. I mean,
talking about idolaters and people who believed in other gods.
If you want to critique some other version of Christianity, that's fine. But I defend the version of Christianity that's Reformed Orthodox.
Oh, so I see. So it's okay for you to cherry pick verses, but if I then read
No, we don't cherry pick. If you, I mean, you can go through if you can go through a Reformed exegetical discussion of Romans 1 and prove that they've made incorrect hermeneutical errors, then that's one thing. That's an argument you have. That's an option you have, Alex Button, but I don't think you can do that. I'm very confident in our understanding of not just Romans 1, but all of Scripture that teaches things like unbelievers are in rebellion, not just physical rebellion, but intellectual rebellion. So you do, if Christianity is true, you are suppressing his truth with lies. But one more point that I want to make is that you, Alex Button, are not even an authority on what you think, because I don't even grant that you know first-person propositional states. I don't think that you know that you believe anything.
Calvinism has now reached a point of such absolute, absolute evil that it now denies people their own thoughts.
Well, it's not just Calvinism, it's actually contemporary philosophy. So there's a lot of discussion in contemporary philosophy right now. How can people know their own first-person propositional states? I mean, are you claiming that you have some magical epistemic access to your own thoughts somehow?
My own. You're asking if I have access to my own thoughts.
Yeah. How do you even know that there is a you doing the thinking? I mean, that's the thing that Bertrand Russell brought up against the great Rene Descartes. I think, therefore, I am argument, right? How does Descartes even know there's an I doing the thinking to begin with? He doesn't. I mean, if we take David Hume, I'm sure you're familiar with David Hume's.
You do a lot of name dropping, don't you?
Well, I don't want to name drop. I'm just trying to isn't Calvin.
You've asked me a question. How do I know that I am having thoughts? But you are assuming that I do by asking the question.
Let me expound on this really quick. David Hume makes this awesome argument against inductive inferences by demonstrating that we cannot empirically verify causation between events. Now, what this means for thoughts is that we can't even empirically verify causation between different thoughts. So this is what led to David Hume's bundle theory of mind. I mean, you can't, all that you can say is that there is a bunch of perceptions happening that you call yourself out of habit, but you can't even say with any surety that you have any special epistemic access to your own thoughts. I don't even grant you that much, Alex Button. That's how much hurt you're in as an unbeliever. Accept Christ, and you can have. Well, you won't admit it, but you can't have any kind of philosophically sound argumentation, as we've demonstrated.
Let me put it this way: I am so confident in my position that I am willing to stake my eternal existence upon it. If I am wrong, I will be tortured for eternity by the loving God that you believe in. Yeah. If I'm right, it doesn't matter. Now, I am that confident in my position. You're so craven in your position that you have bowed down to a cosmic monster that doesn't even exist. You've enslaved yourself to something that's not even true, and you've allowed that to justify some of the most obscene thoughts and political and racial beliefs I've ever encountered. To be honest, you're not a particularly nice human being. You're not very good at making your argument, and I think we ought to pull the plug on this, because you've not really come up with anything new. You've not defended your position effectively. You've just asserted that I haven't given you answers when I have. You've refused to give me answers. And to be honest, I think you're a racist, misogynist, homophobe who I ideally hope that your absolutely vile theocracy never gets any grounding, because if the whole world was run by people like you, it would be just as bad as if Hitler had won the Second World War.
Well, hey, I guess this is a good place to end, and I love you too. In response,
no, I don't love you because I think you're a vile human being.
Yeah, I love you too.
You misheard what I said. There, I said I don't love you. You can't say I love you too back. You can say that you love me, but you don't know me, so you don't love me at all. That's a lie. I don't love you because I think you're an appalling human being. I think you have to take a long, hard look at just how awful your views are, because you're one step away from being a neo-Nazi, and you hate people because of their sexuality.
I don't
How
hate
do you
anybody.
Justify that?
Well,
you would see homosexuals murdered because they are gay. You would see people who are gay murdered. You think that is acceptable? You would see people enslaved. You think that's acceptable?
Not black people specifically.
Well, anybody. You would see another human being enslaved. If you have said yourself that you're
I don't want anybody murdered.
you have told me as well that if your God told you to, you would rape babies.
Why wouldn't I as a Christian? I mean, if God tells me to do something, I'm obligated to do it.
Why wouldn't
I don't understand
you as a
why?
Christian? I think because, on those words, I'm going to eject you from the hangout. Why wouldn't you rape babies
a minute,
as a Christian? Bye-bye.
Okay.
Holy fuck. What an incredibly awful human being. Yeah, I've given him far too much time there, haven't I? I'm going to go now. I'm going to go and be a little bit sick. Thank you for watching.